it works. It is not perfect. It can be misused. It is only a tool. But it is by far the best tool we have, self-correcting, ongoing, applicable to everything. It has two rules. First, there are no sacred truths. All assumptions must be critically examined. Arguments from authority are worthless. Second, whatever is inconsistent with the facts must be discarded or revised. We must understand the cosmos as it is and not confuse how it is with how we wish it to be. The obvious is sometimes false. The unexpected is sometimes true. Humans everywhere share the same goals when the context is large enough. And the study of the cosmos provides the largest possible context. Present global culture is a kind of arrogant newcomer. It arrives on the planetary stage following 4.5 billion years of other acts, and, after looking about for a few thousand years, declares itself in possession of eternal truths. But in a world that is changing as fast as ours, this is a prescription for disaster. No nation, no religion, no economic system, no body of knowledge is likely to have all the answers for our survival. There must be many social systems that would work far better than any now in existence. In the scientific tradition, our task is to find them. Only once before in our history was there the promise of a brilliant scientific civilization. Beneficiary of the Ionian Awakening, it had its citadel at the Library of Alexandria, where 2,000 years ago, the best minds of antiquity established the foundations for the systematic study of mathematics, physics, biology, astronomy, literature, geography, and medicine. We build on those foundations still. The library was constructed and supported by the Ptolemies, the Greek kings, who inherited the Egyptian portion of the empire of Alexander the Great. From the time of its creation in the 3rd century BC until its destruction, 7 centuries later, it was the brain and heart of the ancient world. Alexandria was the publishing capital of the planet. Of course, there were no printing presses then. Books were expensive. Every one of them was copied by hand. The library was the repository of the most accurate copies in the world. The art of critical editing was invented there. The Old Testament comes down to us mainly from the Greek translations made in the Alexandrian Library. The Ptolemies devoted much of their enormous wealth to the acquisition of every Greek book, as well as works from Africa, Persia, India, Israel, and other parts of the world. Ptolemy III Eurygetes wished to borrow from Athens the original manuscripts or official state copies of the great ancient tragedies of Sophocles, Aeschylus, and Euripides. To the Athenians, these were a kind of cultural patrimony, something like the original handwritten copies and first folios of Shakespeare might be in England. They were reluctant to let the manuscripts out of their hands, even for a moment. Only after Ptolemy guaranteed their return with an enormous cash deposit did they agree to lend the plays. But Ptolemy valued those scrolls more than gold or silver. He forfeited the deposit gladly and enshrined, as well he might, the originals in the library. The outraged Athenians had to content themselves with the copies that Ptolemy, only a little shamefacedly, presented to them. Rarely has a state so avidly supported the pursuit of knowledge. The Ptolemies did not merely collect established knowledge. They encouraged and financed scientific research and so generated new knowledge. The results were amazing. Eratosthenes accurately calculated the size of the Earth, mapped it, and argued that India could be reached by sailing westward from Spain. Hipparchus anticipated that stars come into being, slowly move during the course of centuries, and eventually perish. It was he who first cataloged the positions and magnitudes of the stars to detect such changes. Euclid produced a textbook on geometry from which humans learned for 23 centuries, a work that was to help awaken the scientific interest of Kepler, Newton, and Einstein. Galen wrote basic works on healing and anatomy, which dominated medicine until the Renaissance. There were, as we have noted, many others. Alexandria was the greatest city the Western world had ever seen. People of all nations came there to live, to trade, to learn. On any given day, its harbors were thronged with merchants, scholars, and tourists. This was a city where Greeks, Egyptians, Arabs, Syrians, Hebrews, Persians, Nubians, Phoenicians, Italians, Gauls, and Iberians exchanged merchandise and ideas. It is probably here that the word cosmopolitan realized its true meaning. Citizen not just of a nation, but of the cosmos. To be a citizen of the cosmos. Here, clearly, were the seeds of the modern world. What prevented them from taking root and flourishing? Why, instead, did the West slumber through 1,000 years of darkness until Columbus and Copernicus and their contemporaries rediscovered the work done in Alexandria? I cannot give you a simple answer, but I do know this. There is no record in the entire history of the library that any of its illustrious scientists and scholars ever seriously challenged the political, economic, and religious assumptions of their society. The permanence of the stars was questioned, the justice of slavery was not. Science and learning in general were the preserve of a privileged few. The vast population of the city had not the vaguest notion of the great discoveries taking place within the library. New findings were not explained or popularized. The research benefited them little. Discoveries in mechanics and steam technology were applied mainly to the perfection of weapons, the encouragement of superstition, the amusement of kings. The scientists never grasped the potential of machines to free people. The great intellectual achievements of antiquity had few immediate practical applications. Science never captured the imagination of the multitude. There was no counterbalance to stagnation, to pessimism, to the most abject surrenders to mysticism. When, at long last, the mob came to burn the library down, there was nobody to stop them. The last scientist who worked in the library was a mathematician, astronomer, physicist, and the head of the Neoplatonic School of Philosophy, an extraordinary range of accomplishments for any individual in any age. Her name was Hypatia. She was born in Alexandria in 370. At a time when women had few options and were treated as property, Hypatia moved freely and unselfconsciously through traditional male domains. By all accounts, she was a great beauty. She had many suitors, but rejected all offers of marriage. The Alexandria of Hypatia's time, by then long under Roman rule, was a city under grave strain. Slavery had sapped classical civilization of its vitality. The growing Christian church was consolidating its power and attempting to eradicate pagan influence and culture. Hypatia stood at the epicenter of these mighty social forces. Cyril, the Archbishop of Alexandria, despised her because of her close friendship with the Roman governor and because she was a symbol of learning and science, which were largely identified by the early church with paganism. In great personal danger, she continued to teach and publish until, in the year 415, on her way to work, she was set upon by a fanatical mob of Cyril's parishioners. They dragged her from her chariot, tore off her clothes, and, armed with abalone shells, flayed her flesh from her bones. Her remains were burned, her works obliterated, her name forgotten. Cyril was made a saint. The glory of the Alexandrian Library is a dim memory. Its last remnants were destroyed soon after Hypatia's death. It was as if the entire civilization had undergone some self-inflicted brain surgery, and most of its memories, discoveries, ideas and passions were extinguished irrevocably. The loss was incalculable. In some cases, we know only the tantalizing titles of the works that were destroyed. In most cases, we know neither the titles nor the authors. We do know that of the 123 plays of Sophocles in the library, only 7 survived. One of those seven is Oedipus Rex. Similar numbers apply to the works of Aeschylus and Euripides. It is a little as if the only surviving works of a man named William Shakespeare were Coriolanus and A Winter's Tale. But we had heard that he had written certain other plays, unknown to us but apparently prized in his time, works entitled Hamlet, Macbeth, Julius Caesar, King Lear, Romeo and Juliet. Of the physical contents of that glorious library, not a single scroll remains. In modern Alexandria, few people have a keen appreciation, much less a detailed knowledge, of the Alexandrian Library, or of the great Egyptian civilization that preceded it for thousands of years. More recent events, other cultural imperatives have taken precedence. The same is true all over the world. We have only the most tenuous contact with our past, and yet just a stone's throw away from the remains of the Serapeum are reminders of many civilizations. Enigmatic sphinxes from Pharaonic Egypt, a great column erected to the Roman Emperor Diocletian by a provincial flunky for not altogether permitting the citizens of Alexandria to starve to death, a Christian church, many minarets, and the hallmarks of modern industrial civilization, apartment houses, automobiles, streetcars, urban slums, a microwave relay tower. There are a million threads from the past intertwined to make the ropes and cables of the modern world. Our achievements rest on the accomplishments of 40,000 generations of our human predecessors, all but a tiny fraction of whom are nameless and forgotten. Every now and then, we stumble on a major civilization, such as the ancient culture of Ebla, which flourished only a few millennia ago and about which we knew nothing. How ignorant we are of our own past. Inscriptions, papyruses, books time-bind the human species and permit us to hear those few voices and faint cries of our brothers and sisters, our ancestors, and what a joy of recognition when we realize how like us they were. We have, in this book, devoted attention to some of our ancestors whose names have not been lost. Eratosthenes, Democritus, Aristarchus, Hypatia, Leonardo, Kepler, Newton, Huygens, Champollion, Humason, Goddard, Einstein, all from Western culture because the emerging scientific civilization on our planet is mainly a Western civilization. But every culture, China, India, West Africa, Mesoamerica, has made its major contributions to our global society and had its seminal thinkers. Through technological advances in communication, our planet is in the final stages of being bound up at a breakneck pace into a single global society. If we can accomplish the integration of the Earth without obliterating cultural differences or destroying ourselves, we will have accomplished a great thing. Near the site of the Alexandrian Library, there is today a headless sphinx, sculpted in the time of the pharaoh Horemheb in the 18th dynasty, a millennium before Alexander. Within easy view of that leonine body is a modern microwave relay tower. Between them runs an unbroken thread in the history of the human species. From sphinx to tower is an instant of cosmic time, a moment in the 15 or so billion years that have elapsed since the Big Bang. Almost all record of the passage of the universe from then to now has been scattered by the winds of time. The evidence of cosmic evolution has been more thoroughly ravaged than all the papyrus scrolls in the Alexandrian Library. And yet, through daring and intelligence, we have stolen a few glimpses of that winding path along which our ancestors and we have traveled. For unknown ages, after the explosive outpouring of matter and energy of the Big Bang, the cosmos was without form. There were no galaxies, no planets, no life. Deep, impenetrable darkness was everywhere, hydrogen atoms in the void. Here and there, denser accumulations of gas were imperceptibly growing, globes of matter were condensing, hydrogen raindrops more massive than suns. Within these globes of gas was first kindled the nuclear fire latent in matter. A first generation of stars was born, flooding the cosmos with light. There were, in those times, not yet any planets to receive the light, no living creatures to admire the radiance of the heavens. Deep in the stellar furnaces, the alchemy of nuclear fusion created heavy elements, the ashes of hydrogen burning, the atomic building materials of future planets and life forms. Massive stars soon exhausted their stores of nuclear fuel. Rocked by colossal explosions, they returned most of their substance back into the thin gas from which they had once condensed. Here, in the dark, lush clouds between the stars, new raindrops made of many elements were forming, later generations of stars being born. Nearby, smaller raindrops grew, bodies far too little to ignite the nuclear fire, droplets in the interstellar mist on their way to form the planets. Among them was a small world of stone and iron, the early Earth. Congealing and warming, the Earth released the methane, ammonia, water, and hydrogen gases that had been trapped within, forming the primitive atmosphere and the first oceans. Starlight from the sun bathed and warmed the primeval Earth, drove storms, generated lightning and thunder. Volcanoes overflowed with lava. These processes disrupted molecules of the primitive atmosphere. The fragments fell back together again into more and more complex forms, which dissolved in the early oceans. After a time, the seas achieved the consistency of a warm, dilute soup. Molecules were organized and complex chemical reactions driven on the surface of clays. And one day, a molecule arose that, quite by accident, was able to make crude copies of itself out of the other molecules in the broth. As time passed, more elaborate and more accurate self-replicating molecules arose. Those combinations best suited to further replication were favored by the sieve of natural selection. Those that copied better produced more copies, and the primitive oceanic broth gradually grew thin as it was consumed by and transformed into complex condensations of self-replicating organic molecules. Gradually, imperceptibly, life had begun. Single-cell plants evolved, and life began to generate its own food. Photosynthesis transformed the atmosphere. Sex was invented. Once, free living forms banded together to make a complex cell with specialized functions. Chemical receptors evolved, and the cosmos could taste and smell. One-celled organisms evolved into multicellular colonies, elaborating their various parts into specialized organ systems. Eyes and ears evolved, and now the cosmos could see and hear. Plants and animals discovered that the land could support life. Organisms buzzed, crawled, scuttled, lumbered, glided, flapped, shimmied, climbed, and soared. Colossal beasts thundered through the steaming jungles. Small creatures emerged, born live instead of in hard-shelled containers, with a fluid like the early oceans coursing through their veins. They survived by swiftness and cunning. And then, only a moment ago, some small arboreal animals scampered down from the trees. They became upright and taught themselves the use of tools, domesticated other animals, plants, and fire, and devised language. The ash of stellar alchemy was now emerging into consciousness. At an ever-accelerating pace, it invented writing, cities, art, and science, and sent spaceships to the planets and the stars. These are some of the things that hydrogen atoms do, given 15 billion years of cosmic evolution. It has the sound of epic myth, and rightly, but it is simply a description of cosmic evolution as revealed by the science of our time. We are difficult to come by, and a danger to ourselves, but any account of cosmic evolution makes it clear that all the creatures of the Earth, the latest manufacturers of the galactic hydrogen industry, are beings to be cherished. Elsewhere, there may be other equally astonishing transmutations of matter, so wistfully we listen for a humming in the sky. We have held the peculiar notion that a person or society that is a little different from us, whoever we are, is somehow strange or bizarre, to be distrusted or loathed. Think of the negative connotations of words like alien or outlandish. And yet the monuments and cultures of each of our civilizations merely represent different ways of being human. An extraterrestrial visitor, looking at the differences among human beings in their societies, would find those differences trivial compared to the similarities. The cosmos may be densely populated with intelligent beings, but the Darwinian lesson is clear. There will be no humans elsewhere, only here, only on this small planet. We are a rare as well as an endangered species. Every one of us is, in the cosmic perspective, precious. If a human disagrees with you, let him live. In 100 billion galaxies, you will not find another. Human history can be viewed as a slowly dawning awareness that we are members of a larger group. Initially, our loyalties were to ourselves and our immediate family. Next, to bands of wandering hunter-gatherers. Then to tribes, small settlements, city-states, nations. We have broadened the circle of those we love. We have now organized what are modestly described as superpowers, which include groups of people from divergent ethnic and cultural backgrounds, working in some sense together, surely a humanizing and character-building experience. If we are to survive, our loyalties must be broadened further to include the whole human community, the entire planet Earth. Many of those who run the nations will find this idea unpleasant. They will fear the loss of power. We will hear much about treason and disloyalty. Rich nation states will have to share their wealth with poor ones. But the choice, as H.G. Wells once said in a different context, is clearly the universe or nothing. A few million years ago, there were no humans. Who will be here a few million years hence? In all the 4.6 billion year history of our planet, nothing much ever left it. But now, tiny, unmanned exploratory spacecraft from Earth are moving, glistening, and elegant through the solar system. We have made a preliminary reconnaissance of 20 worlds. Among them, all the planets visible to the naked eye, all those wandering nocturnal lights that stirred our ancestors toward understanding and ecstasy. If we survive, our time will be famous for two reasons. That, at this dangerous moment of technological adolescence, we managed to avoid self-destruction. And because this is the epoch in which we began our journey to the stars. The choice is stark and ironic. The same rocket boosters used to launch probes to the planets are poised to send nuclear warheads to the nations. The radioactive power sources on Viking and Voyager derive from the same technology that makes nuclear weapons. The radio and radar techniques employed to track and guide ballistic missiles and defend against attack are also used to monitor and command the spacecraft on the planets and to listen for signals from civilizations near other stars. If we use these technologies to destroy ourselves, we surely will venture no more to the planets and the stars. But the converse is also true. If we continue to the planets and the stars, our chauvinisms will be shaken further. We will gain a cosmic perspective. We will recognize that our explorations can be carried out only on behalf of all the people of the planet Earth. We will invest our energies in an enterprise devoted not to death, but to life, the expansion of our understanding of the Earth and its inhabitants, and the search for life elsewhere. Space exploration, unmanned and manned, uses many of the same technological and organizational skills and demands the same commitment to valor and daring as does the enterprise of war. Should a time of real disarmament arrive before nuclear war, such exploration would enable the military-industrial establishments of the major powers to engage at long last in an untainted enterprise. Interest vested in preparations for war can relatively easily be reinvested in the exploration of the cosmos. A reasonable, even an ambitious program of unmanned exploration of the planets is inexpensive. The budget for space sciences in the United States and the Soviet Union together represents the equivalent of 2 or 3 nuclear submarines per decade, or the cost overruns on one of the many weapon systems in a single year. In the last quarter of 1979, the program cost of the U.S. F-A-18 aircraft increased by $5.1 billion, and the F-16 by $3.4 billion. Since their inceptions, significantly less has been spent on the unmanned planetary programs of both the United States and the Soviet Union than has been wasted shamefully. For example, between 1970 and 1975, in the U.S. bombing of Cambodia, an application of national policy that cost $7 billion. The total cost of a mission such as Viking to Mars or Voyager to the outer solar system is less than that of the 1979-80 Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. Through technical employment and the stimulation of high technology, money spent on space exploration has an economic multiplier effect. One study suggests that for every dollar spent on the planets, $7 are returned to the national economy. And yet, there are many important and entirely feasible missions that have not been attempted because of lack of funds, including roving vehicles to wander across the surface of Mars, a comet rendezvous, Titan entry probes, and a full-scale search for radio signals from other civilizations in space. The cost of major ventures into space, permanent bases on the moon, or human exploration of Mars, say, is so large that they will not, I think, be mustered in the very near future unless we make dramatic progress in nuclear and conventional disarmament. Even then, there are probably more pressing needs here on Earth, but I have no doubt that if we avoid self-destruction, we will sooner or later perform such missions. It is almost impossible to maintain a static society. There is a kind of psychological compound interest. Even a small tendency toward retrenchment, a turning away from the cosmos, adds up over many generations to a significant decline. And conversely, even a slight commitment to ventures beyond the Earth, to what we might call, after Columbus, the enterprise of the stars, builds over many generations to a significant human presence on other worlds, a rejoicing in our participation in the cosmos. Some 3.6 million years ago, in what is now northern Tanzania, a volcano erupted, the resulting cloud of ash covering the surrounding savannas. In 1979, the paleoanthropologist Mary Leakey found in that ash footprints. The footprints, she believes, of an early hominid, perhaps an ancestor of all the people on the Earth today. And 380,000 kilometers away, in a flat, dry plain that humans have in a moment of optimism called the Sea of Tranquility, there is another footprint, left by the first human to walk another world. We have come far in 3.6 million years, and in 4.6 billion, and in 15 billion. For we are the local embodiment of a cosmos grown to self-awareness. We have begun to contemplate our origins, star stuff, pondering the stars, organized assemblages of 10 billion 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 atoms, considering the evolution of atoms, tracing the long journey by which, here at last, consciousness arose. Our loyalties are to the species and the planet. We speak for Earth. Our obligation to survive is owed not just to ourselves, but also to that cosmos, ancient and vast, from which we spring. We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of Cosmos, A Personal Voyage by Carl Sagan. performed by LeVar Burton, Anne Druyan, Seth MacFarlane, and Neil deGrasse Tyson. Performance copyright 2017 by Brilliance Publishing, Inc., all rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.